From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how the Central Valley's air quality is doing with the recent very hot weather. Plus, a new book tells the story of Alcatraz when it was home to some of America's most notorious criminals, and the Americana quintet Houston Jones. But first, the homeless shelter at Cal Expo finally closed this morning. It's usually only open in the winter. It stayed open later than usual as part of a deal to close Sacramento's so-called Tent City. What happens to the people who are staying at Cal Expo? Joining us with answers is Tim Brown, director of the Sacramento Ending Chronic Homelessness Initiative. Tim, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for having me.
How many people were still at the Cal Expo shelter when it closed?
A couple hundred people. It was pretty full.
And they're not used to being there at this time of year.
No, the shelter is usually open from late November through March, the cold weather months, sometimes into April if it's a bad year. But again, this was extended for up to 3 months because of the Tent City.
It was part of a deal then. That was part of the overall deal to close the Tent City that had become something of an embarrassment to the city and the region. And part of the deal was that shelter beds would be available at Cal Expo for another few months.
Yes, exactly.
Of course, those few months are now up.
Yeah, so at least the weather's better. But and as part of that deal, we also added about 80 units of or 40 new units. We had 40 units already coming online for permanent housing for people, and we've so far housed about or filled about half of those units with people from the Tent City who actually got into permanent housing.
Why are the other units not filled yet?
It just takes a while to lease up housing and get it ready, and then we had some, and you have to have services attached to the housing. And in this budget, it's crunch. It's been really hard to piece together the service piece. But we managed to do that, and we're a little bit slower than we wanted to be, but we still have another 35, 40 people to house in the next month or so.
And where are these housing units? Are they clustered in one place?
No, they're scattered sites. They're basically our nonprofit partners lease up single-family homes for the most part, and people share the housing, usually up to maybe five people in a house.
Do you know how many of the people who were at Cal Expo until just about now, how many of them were previously staying in the Tent City?
Not so many. We think maybe 30 or 40 folks from the Tent City used the shelter at some point. There's about 20 people from the Tent City, I think, still left at the shelter at the end here.
So was keeping Cal Expo open longer really helpful in terms of closing the Tent City?
Well, it was helpful in terms of couples particularly because one of the things that happened at the Cal Expo shelter was they expanded by 50 beds, and most of those beds accommodated couples. And couples before, many of them and many of them who were in the Tent City wouldn't use the shelters because they wanted to be together and they couldn't stay together in the shelters. So that was one thing that was most of the people who came from the Tent City weren't couples actually that went to the Cal Expo, and it was nice for them.
I read that it costs about $140,000 a month to operate that shelter. Is that the most effective use of that money for the number of people who were staying at Cal Expo?
Well, it's a very expensive program. There's no question about that. We're struggling this year. It was looking much worse, I should say, a few weeks ago when there were as many as 320 shelter beds on the cut list for Sacramento County. And we were really afraid that not only was Cal Expo going to close, but we were at risk of losing another 160 shelter beds or so. And the Board of Supervisors and the Department of Human Assistance really patched things together and came through to keep those other shelters open. So at least we have the same number of shelters, besides the winter shelter bed for people to move into. And we think about 30 or so folks from the winter shelter are going to access shelter beds in the other existing shelters.
Usually only winter only shelter for homeless people at Cal Expo just closed today. It was part of a deal to close Sacramento's Tent City earlier in the year. We're getting sort of a general update on what's happening to the people who were staying at Cal Expo and homelessness in general. Tim Brown is director of the Sacramento Ending Chronic Homelessness Initiative. Do you know where the people who were staying at Cal Expo will go now?
Well, again, some of them will go to the shelters, maybe 30 or so. We also have potentially 30 or 40 people and families and couples who will get motel vouchers because as part of the stimulus plan, there's some new community service block grant money that came to agencies for safety net services. So we do have a little bit of new resource there. But I think it's safe to say that most of the people will not have a place to go. And that's typically what happens when the winter shelter closes.
So a certain percentage of them will be back in the streets.
Yes.
As it happens, well, probably not really as it happens, there's a march and a rally going on today in downtown Sacramento. calling for a, quote, safe ground site, which would be a sort of permanent campsite for homeless people. And Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler is there. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Could you tell us what you're seeing, what's happening?
Well, I think at this point everyone's gathering, and there do appear to be several hundred people. I don't know the exact breakdown on how many of them are homeless, how many of them are with Loaves and Fishes, how many of them are with other organizations, and how many people are just here because they feel like they want to do whatever they can to help. But the plan is to rally here for maybe an hour or so, and then at about 11 o'clock, the plan is to march over to a location about less than a mile from here, fairly close to a major city building and city-owned property, and to then rally there and say, we want a safe ground. And they're working it out with police, but it appears that they're going to try to stay there for a while. They say no one wants to get arrested, and that's not the plan. And that is in contrast to the end of the tent city, when the city did close that tent city down. There were some backers of homeless advocates who said they were willing to get arrested. I don't think that's the case this time. I don't think that's what they're looking to do. They are looking to call attention to the fact that there are some people who were, in their mind, promised places by the city and county to stay at the winter shelter and elsewhere in permanent housing, and that's not all shaping up yet. I think that's the reason for the rally. They don't want the media attention that came to this issue because of the tent city to just go away.
Right now, you're at the Loaves and Fishes site, which is where a lot of homeless services are offered. Where about are the people marching to? Where is the city-owned site? Do you know?
I do know, but I've been asked to just keep it quiet for a little bit longer until they start marching there. But I can tell you it's not far from Loaves and Fishes. And what I can tell you is it's a city-owned property, and it's in the neighborhood around here.
That site would be the site of this proposed safe ground where homeless people would camp legally if it were accepted?
I think it's the point is to go to a city-owned property and say, look, until you can find somewhere else for us that is a safe ground, that we would like to stay there or that we are planning on staying there. But I don't know if that property in particular is one that they really expect to see as a practical long-term solution. I think they're just saying to the city, in absence of you selecting a property, we will.
I read in a news release about this rally in March that the safe ground would include a fee, a very modest one, admittedly, that would be charged to people who would be staying at the safe ground, $2, say. Have you heard any more about that?
I haven't, but I'm here with a gentleman who was at the tent city, then went to the winter shelter and is now looking for somewhere to go. And as you said that, he looked at me and he nodded. So I guess he knows something about that.
Okay. Well, let's go to him. His name is Richard Aldrett, I believe.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Richard, welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you.
You are currently homeless, correct?
Yes, I am.
Now, and you used to stay at the tent city?
Yes, I did. By Blue Diamond Grocery area.
Okay. And where did you go after that when it shut down?
The Cal Expo Overflow.
So, and have you been there since then?
Yes.
What was it like at the Cal Expo shelter?
Very well. They gave food. The staff members were very caring. They took care of the people there. They have TVs for people to watch, and you get a warm bed. You know, it's nice to have a bed and you can go. You have a place for couples to go to in there also, and you have single dorms for the single people.
What are you going to do now?
Well, I was hoping to get housing, but from when I went to the Sacramento Housing, I was told I have to wait 2 more weeks. And when I was on the list for a priority for 4 couples, I was just waiting. So I've been waiting.
Are you part of a couple?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been homeless?
I've been homeless for like 7 months.
And what was your situation before that?
I worked at a restaurant, and then I worked at Blue Diamond Growers.
Not too far from where the tent city was.
Exactly.
What happened? Why did you lose your job? Why are you homeless? Can you tell us?
Just job eliminations. They wanted to cut seniority. You cut seniority, you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay, so much insurance. And you hire temps.
Now it sounds like you are hoping to, expecting to get some housing soon. If that works out, separate from that, what do you think about the idea of a safe ground where homeless people could camp?
I think it's wonderful because, believe me, my girlfriend was harassed by the police as she was walking down the street with her dog. And they stopped her and they questioned her, where did you get that dog from? Where did you steal the dog from? Where did you steal your bike from? And they said, where are you going from here? Are you going to go out and buy drugs? What are you doing? And she's not doing anything. And she was just coming back to loaves of fishes from taking her dog to the park.
Now, I've heard that there would be perhaps a small fee for homeless people who would stay at the safe ground if this actually happens. Do you support that idea of charging a couple of dollars to a homeless person?
Well, they have to pay for the dome tents. They're very beautiful. These tents that they got, they're very sturdy. They handle the wind, they handle the rain. I mean, it's a wonderful idea to have these little dome tents. They're great. I mean, and it's nice to have a permanent area where you can have people go and leave, and you can lock your door on there, too.
Richard Aldrett, thanks very much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I don't know if he's sharing a phone with Ben Adler.
Okay. No, we're actually sitting next to each other, each holding a phone.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ben. Anything else you'd like to add?
I would just describe the tent that Richard was just describing and give the listeners a better idea. I was just shown it before I came on the show. It's probably about 15 feet tall, and the diameter is probably, I'd say 15, 20 feet wide. It's quite roomy. There was a futon in there. It's actually air-conditioned. There's a small air-conditioning unit in the side. There's, a small light bulb plugged in, and, there is a bookshelf. And what I was told by Joan Burke with Loaves and Fishes, who I know has been a guest on Insight before, is that that one is an example, and they've got one other that's going to be over at the other rally site, the city-owned property, and that I believe they're looking at trying to get some more of those, but as of yet, Loaves and Fishes has just purchased two of them. I don't know how practical it is to get one of those for every individual or every couple who is homeless in Sacramento County. I don't think that's really a long-term solution, but it's certainly one of the many things that Loaves and Fishes is looking at for a very, very short-term solution.
Okay. Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tim Brown, director of the Sacramento Ending Chronic Homeless Initiative, is still with us in the studio. Tim, how many homeless people are there right about now?
We counted in January 2,800 homeless people, and about 1,200 are on the streets. So the other, 1,600 or so are actually in shelters or transitional housing or permanent housing. And, the 10-year plan focus has really been on housing, and that's why we haven't really so much got into the tent city kind of things, because it takes a lot of energy just to get housing online, and it takes years to actually build a rehab housing. But in 2 years, we've housed 320 chronic homeless people, and this homeless count showed that chronic homelessness decreased by 35% in Sacramento, which is one of the best results.
Since when?
Since January of 2007, in those 2 years.
Despite the economy being so bad?
Overall homelessness, because there are newer homeless and especially newer families, has gone up 14%. But the chronic people who are usually on the streets for years and have multiple disabilities who our focus is on, we've got one of the best results in the country in terms of housing those people. And that's the majority of people at the tent city were actually chronic homeless people, probably about 75%.
The focus of your organization is on permanent housing for currently homeless people. Still, do you have a position on the tent city? On a safe ground, a permanent campsite for homeless people, or a semi-permanent campsite?
We don't have a position other than it hasn't been our focus. Some members, Loaves and Fishes is one of our members. They obviously have that position. I know the mayor has been open to that position, but we haven't ever come to any agreement about that.
Finally, money. You mentioned stimulus money. This is federal stimulus money coming in October to help reduce the impact of homelessness.
Yeah, this is really huge. We're getting, Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. We're going to get almost $5 million between the city and the county, and we're going to apply for the other cities within the county, hopefully. And it looks like we may have as much as $7 or $8 million over 3 years to prevent homelessness and to rapidly rehouse people, which means the people who are in the shelters, we try to get them back into housing as soon as possible, private housing with rental assistance, with utility assistance, and with housing location and housing counseling support. It's really the national model that I think the HUD and the federal government's moving to, and we're excited to really have some serious resources to do that.
On the other hand, the state's budget is still in deficit. the state is starting to send out IOUs to providers that it works with. Are you one of those?
No, thank goodness, but I feel for the people who are. But you know, the state budget, the longer it takes, it affects everybody. I mean, and you know, when they're talking about even deeper cuts in programs like CalWORKs and health and some of the main really programs that, you know, either cause people to be homeless or help people get out of homelessness, it's going to have a big impact on us.
Tim Brown, director of the Sacramento Ending Chronic Homelessness Initiative. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how the Central Valley's air quality is doing with the recent very hot weather. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is on Facebook. Find us at Insight on Capital Public Radio. The recent very hot weather has had the almost inevitable effect of worsening the Central Valley's air quality. How much worse? What's the air quality trend? And what more can be done to improve it? We're going to talk with guests from two Central Valley air quality districts. In our studio, Larry Green is Executive Director of the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District. Larry, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
How's the air quality in the Sacramento area this week?
Well, we started off with three Spare of the Year days, but the trend over the holiday will be very good. It's a moderating trend and going to have a good fourth.
Yeah. What about before this week when it was really hot? How was the air, generally speaking?
Well, we had those three Spare of the Year days. It peaked on Sunday and got slightly better Monday and Tuesday, and now we're back into a decent air quality trend. Actually, we've had a very cool spring as opposed to last year. If you remember, we were in the middle of all that smoke last year at this time.
Yeah. And on the phone is Anthony Presto, public information representative for the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District's Northern Office in Modesto. Anthony, welcome.
Good morning.
What about the air quality in the northern San Joaquin Valley?
Well, we're experiencing much of the same as they are in Sacramento, as Larry commented. It's not too bad today. As a matter of fact, most of the air quality throughout the valley is moderate, with some areas that are in what we call the orange zone, or unhealthy for sensitive groups. But yeah, we during that hot weather, it was a little worse. But the thing to realize is that we have air quality issues throughout the year, not just in the hot summer days.
Understood. We're focusing, though, on the hot weather issues, given the time of year. Typically speaking, the northern San Joaquin Valley is a little bit hotter than the Sacramento area. Does that lead to slightly worse air quality, Anthony?
That can. We typically, throughout the valley, do have a little bit worse conditions than the Sacramento area. We have a larger air basin, and we actually have the second worst air quality in the nation, second only to Los Angeles. So as we do get hotter and we do have more emissions from more sources, we will get more days that are considered unhealthy.
Larry Green, is it inevitable in the Central Valley that if it's a hot weather day, an unusually hot weather day, that the air quality is going to get bad?
Well, you would think that. A couple of things are helping us out. First of all, our vehicles have been getting cleaner. We see a very nice trend over the years of it takes more pollution, it takes hotter days for us to have an exceedance. So we have seen that as a steady trend over the years. If you look back over the past 30 years, we started out with a disadvantage, though, because of the basin quality of the Central Valley. So we have a little harder hurdle to go over than other parts of the country may.
When there's a Spare the Air Day, there are announcements in the media, and people are asked to do things like drive less and do other things that are friendly to the air. Larry, how do you know whether or not the Spare the Air Day announcements and calls for action actually work?
Well, we have a program where we go out after the Spare of the Air days and we call people and we check, did you know it was a Spare of the Air day? What did you do? What difference? And we actually calculate that. We've been doing that program for so long through standard techniques that EPA allows us to actually claim some air credit in our state implementation plan for that. So we do check and we do know it's making an impact.
Anthony, what about in the San Joaquin Valley? Do you have reason to believe that people are actually acting on the advice and suggestions that you give them?
Well, that's where we've made a change. We did have a Spare the Air program for 11 years in the San Joaquin Valley that we did not think was making a big enough impact. Even though air quality has been steadily improving over the past 20 years, what we're finding is here, letting people know the day before we expect a day of unhealthy air that they should drive less is not a big enough impact. Even though it did have some improvement, we need people to actually make air quality a priority in their daily decision making. So to think that way all season long, all summer long, even all year long, is what we need for people to be doing. And that's why we implemented something called healthy air living. So making air quality the priority every day is really the only way we can achieve the air quality improvements that we need.
Well, give us a concrete example of a different way that you're reaching out to people, a different message, a different way of giving a message.
What we are doing now is holding summits for businesses in the Valley because they are a huge part of our air quality issue and have helped us in making improvements. We are also holding what we're calling air quality chats for the general public, and these are something like a very casual, family-friendly presentation that is open for discussion, and we are going to be holding them all throughout the Valley this summer. We've already started. We'll have one in Modesto in July and one in August in Stockton, and we're also having a summit next week in on July 8th in Stockton at the Chamber of Commerce. Okay. We have a brand new website dedicated to healthier living. It's at healthierliving.com that gives residents and businesses all over the Valley all of this information when we'll be holding these events, and also implementing tools that people can use to improve air quality and actually make their mark.
Larry Green, at the Sacramento Air Quality Management District, what more can be done to improve air quality in the summer?
Well, I think that we have many actions underway at the state and federal government. Our vehicles are getting cleaner. We're also having a very good trend of having more infill in the city that we've all noticed.
In other words, more dense living circumstances,
right?
in the city.
Absolutely. Our trend for building and how we're putting our communities together is good. So we have some very positive trends that are part of this whole message that we put out. And we think we see progress as time goes on.
Anthony, is there the same kind of change in living density in places like Modesto and Stockton as you see in Sacramento?
It has been similar. Because of the economic crisis, we're actually seeing not as many people move into the Valley as we had experienced for so many years. And of course, where there's less people, there is less sources of air pollution. However, as I stated, we're not making those improvements fast enough, but we are really looking forward to the improvements that we're going to see in the near future with cleaner vehicles coming on down.
And finally, Larry, is the federal government cracking down harder on places like Sacramento? I know it was an issue in the past, but there's also been a general improvement in air quality. How is the federal government treating places like Sacramento now when it comes to air quality?
Well, I think over the last 10 years, we've turned that trend around. Now they're using us as an example of how you should be doing things. The blueprint that our Sacramento Area Council of Governments put forward has been a renowned example across the nation.
To guide development.
To guide development. We've had a program recently for putting in a number of ethanol stations. We've got an event coming up this summer where we'll have the cleanest passenger locomotive maybe in the United States, certainly in California here. So we are regularly sending out a good message to EPA where we're being leaders rather than responding to things that they're telling to us.
And without getting into another topic, that locomotive, is that a passenger train or is that for a freight?
That will be a passenger locomotive on the Capital Corridor, first one to be upgraded in California.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about that. In the meantime, thanks so much. Larry Green, Executive Director of the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District, and in Modesto, Anthony Presto of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Good to talk with you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a new book tells the story of Alcatraz when it was home to some of America's most notorious criminals. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did something in Insight particularly please you? Tell us what it was and why you liked it at insight@capradio.org. The world's most famous prison opened 75 years ago today. Alcatraz was built to house the nation's most notorious and incorrigible criminals. But as tough as life there was, a lot of mythology about Alcatraz emerged, and real life on the rock was not always what the general public thought and still thinks it was. An exhaustively researched study of Alcatraz has now yielded a book that answers questions and debunks myths. It's called Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. Author David Ward joins us along with co-author Gene Kassebaum. David, Gene, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for asking us.
Thank you.
David, why was Alcatraz prison built in the first place?
Well, people must be aware now with all of the promotion regarding the new film Public Enemies, these folks were careening around the countryside, robbing banks and kidnapping wealthy businessmen for ransom. Local police didn't seem to be able to deal with them, so the request was made to the federal government to do something that resulted in the creation of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. But when his super cops caught the super criminals, they needed a super prison to lock them up in, and Alcatraz was designated as that spot, a rocky island in the middle of San Francisco Bay that people could see but nobody could get to.
And how tough was life on Alcatraz?
Well, Alcatraz was a tough prison. It had no commissary, no newspapers, no magazines. The inmates were locked up for the day at 4:45 in the afternoon. There were no programs, no social workers, no psychologists. Inmates had one privilege, and that was going to work, which meant you could get out of your cell for a few hours each day. The silent system was in place in the early years, and they also locked up men in underground dungeons that were occupied by strikers in the 1930s. So it was a very, very tough place.
We're talking about the new book, Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. Gene Kassebaum, how secure was Alcatraz? Is it true that no one actually escaped alive?
Well, it hasn't been verified that anyone survived beyond getting into the bay. A couple of escapes resulted where no body was ever retrieved. One guy made it as far as the base pylon of the Golden Gate Bridge, but was exhausted by that time and was retaken. So we haven't had any, we've had a couple of escapes that have been indecisive. You can't tell whether they got away completely or not, but nobody ever sent a postcard saying, yeah, 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 warden. So it's it looks as though maybe nobody ever got out.
David, in the preface, you wrote, quote, "Toughing it out at Alcatraz might, for some convicted felons, represent an opportunity to show that a man could take the worst that the federal government could dish out." End of quote. That suggests that Alcatraz had a mythology among criminals as well as among the general public.
Yes, it was, of course, intended to present such a harsh image of confinement that that prisoners would not want to act so badly in other federal prisons that they would be sent to the Rock. But, of course, in the world of criminals, particularly during this golden era of the convict code, where convicts stuck together instead of trying to kill each other, going to Alcatraz was like getting admitted to the best graduate school, and inmates were proud of having done time on the Rock because it showed that they could stand up to the worst that the government could throw against them.
Gene, why did you and David focus on the first 15 years or so that, 14 years rather, that Alcatraz was open as a federal prison, the so-called gangster years? Because it was open for longer than that.
Yes, it was. It opened in August of 34 and closed down in March of 63. We took the first period under Warden Johnson, partly because it was then that these colorful bank robbers, kidnappers, and racketeers were sent there during this period when there was an effort made to create a special prison. As time went on, it was still a special prison, but it more and more began after, say, 1948, 1950. It began to resemble other maximum security penitentiaries, and something of that distinctive flavor was lost. But, of course, a lot did happen after the cutoff point of the book.
We're talking about the book Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. My guests are the author David Ward and co-author Gene Kassebaum. They're both sociologists and experts on prisons. Now, David, an important part of the book is about the impact Alcatraz had on the people who were imprisoned there. The inmates during this time were considered incorrigible, literally. They lived under very harsh conditions. They were given no counseling or other programs. And yet, many of them, when they were released, led law-abiding lives. How did that happen?
Well, that's one of the really interesting criminological puzzles in this project, Jeffrey, was to look at how people who were seen as so incorrigible, people that were career criminals, and therefore there would be no reason to waste any rehabilitative personnel or programs on them, how they adjusted to this harsh regime, and then for the gangster era, two-thirds of them never went back to prison when they were finally released. It says something about the ability of these tough guys to survive, to psychologically survive. They had a lot of time on the island in a really monastic regime to think about their lives, and they're getting older, and their families have pretty much forgotten or abandoned them. And they, like any aging person, especially men, I guess, when they get into their late 30s and early 40s, become more reflective and think about what they want to do with the rest of their time. And these guys decided that the rate of return from the bank robberies they had committed, divided by the number of years they were serving time in a tough prison, the rate was pretty poor, and they decided they would like to spend the rest of their lives surrounded by people other than other convicts.
Now, I know this might be difficult to answer, David, but if those prisoners were in a California prison today, would you expect a similar number of them upon release to lead law-abiding lives?
Well, of course, that's a very good question, because to really answer that, we would have had to have a sample of Alcatraz convicts go to a regular prison to see if they would have had the same success rate without the Alcatraz regime. I would say that one of the main things about Alcatraz, and the prisoners really talked to us about it, was the amount of time they had for solitary reflection. When you're locked up for the day at 4:45 and there are no evening activities and you don't have movies and television and radio and newspapers and what have you, there is time for a lot of soulful reflection. I don't think in today's overcrowded California prisons with still many, many programs and activities, the inmates would have been as likely as the Alcatraz convicts said. This was the first time in their lives they stopped running around.
Now, some of the conditions that made Alcatraz tough for the inmates presumably also made it tough for the people who were working there. Gene, what impact did Alcatraz have on the wardens that you spoke with?
Well, the warden during the period of covered by the book was a man who had been a warden previously in a couple of penitentiaries, Johnson. And he, as far as I can determine, maybe David knows more details of it, had a fairly executive type privileged life there, his own house and so on. He was, however, toward the end of his tenure, subject to strong pressures from reformist persons in the Department of in the Bureau of Prisons, and he was embarrassed by some of the escape attempts, and particularly the 1946 riot. So he was under a fair amount of pressure at the end to, I think, to defend his regime.
And David, what about the rank and file staff, the guards?
Well, one of the reasons that the island location was so attractive to the Department of Justice was that when Al Capone and these other gangsters were in standard federal penitentiaries, they had such high status and such influence that they were able to get all kinds of special services and contraband and privileges from the ordinary staff, who were pretty impressed by the reputations of their prisoners. So when Alcatraz was established on an island with no communication allowed with the media on the mainland, it allowed the Bureau of Prisons to isolate the staff as well as the prisoners and keep them, therefore, under very tight control, so that that influence peddling that went on in the regular penitentiaries could not and did not occur at Alcatraz.
And finally, David, Alcatraz was America's first supermax prison. What lesson do you think today's supermax prisons could learn from Alcatraz based on what you learned?
Well, I think that because the prisons that have succeeded it, and the federal prisons at Marion, Illinois, and now at Florence, Colorado, so-called Alcatraz of the Rockies, serve the same function of locking up the nation's most highly publicized bad guys. Our project shows that even these people reform as the years go by. It's true, many years go by, but the aging process has always been the most effective rehabilitation program. And the question would be, for some, but not all, of the people who are locked up in today's supermax prisons, as to whether or not they really need to be kept in the most expensive penitentiaries that we operate, except for medical facilities, for 30, 40 years or more.
That's David Ward, author of Alcatraz, The Gangster Years, co-author Gene Kassebaum. David, Gene, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for asking.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the San Francisco-based Americana group, Houston Jones. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. The San Francisco-based Americana quintet, Houston Jones, is coming back to our area. They're at the Black Oak Casino tonight in Tuolumne and the Woodland Opera House next week. The band stopped by our studio last September and talked with Insight guest host David Watts Barton.
Welcome to Insight.
Oh, thanks, David.
Thank you.
Glenn, you're the guitar player in the band, and
yes.
Before we get much further in, I just wanted to let people hear some of your playing.
Okay.
This is from your album Three Crow Town, which
right.
is your third album, I
yes.
believe. This is called Daily's Real.
Okay.
That is Daily's Real by Houston Jones from the Bay Area, San Francisco.
Yes. Most of us live in the East Bay. Henry is the exception, lives in Brisbane.
Oh, okay. You know, I read in your bio that you cite Mike Bloomfield and Albert King as your influences, and I'm not hearing that at all.
Well, you won't hear it in that music. There is, once in a while, we'll pull out an electric blues and we'll play that. Michael Bloomfield, probably my biggest influence blues-wise.
Hmm.
In fact, a few years back, there was a several gigs in memory of Mike Bloomfield, and Mark Naftalin and Nick Gravanites joined us, and I played guitar and did the Mike Bloomfield stuff. But we don't do a lot of blues in this band. but I was strongly influenced by that.
Mm-hmm. But you do play electric guitar then quite
yes,
a bit.
Yes.
But in Houston Jones, do you play electric guitar?
It's a small part of what we do. I might play three or four electric guitar tunes in an evening.
He sneaks it in when he can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you and Henry, you play mostly accordion or mostly piano? Or
it's
do you
mostly sing? Piano. I fake it on the accordion technically, but for a lot of the tunes we do, it fits the character of the song really well. Actually, that's how I snuck into the band. They needed some accordion overdubs on Three Crowed in Town, and when I heard the songs, I said, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I got to get in this band.
And what bands have you been in the past?
Oh, so I was in a band called Johnny Nocturne in San Francisco for quite a while, sort of a rhythm and blues jump big band. And I've played country, blues, rock, jazz, just real musical slut.
All those kinds of music come out in the music. It's hard. It's hard to really nail down. That's why the term Americana has become quite handy for people to toss at anybody that plays a lot of different styles of music.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a lot of what we do is are very acoustic based. That kind of helps that. You know, upright bass player, and I play piano a lot. So sort of gives it a little glue to hold it together.
How does that work live, though, particularly for you, Glenn? Because acoustic guitars live, particularly when you're picking the way you are, it's a little bit hard for them to come across in a band sometimes live, which is kind of why the electric guitar was developed in the first place.
Well, that's a really good question, and we have to take extra care with the sound man and the system to do a sound check where we have a good, crisp, clear amplification. This would have been very difficult to pull off 30 years ago when PA systems were more primitive. But that works because we're able to do that. In fact, when we do a sound check, Travis is fond of pointing out that he's playing rhythm guitar and he's hitting six strings at a time, and I'm hitting one string at a time. So as we adjust volumes, we have to take that into consideration. So it works out. Mm-hmm. And for those gigs where we bring our own sound, we have really kind of a world-class system, and we take care of that. So it works out fine.
I'm speaking with Henry Salvia and Glenn Houston of the band Houston Jones. I wanted to play another song. There's a song on the new album, Calico Heart, called Mighty Red, that starts off as a very sort of New Orleans second line feel, and about halfway through you realize that you're listening to salsa almost. How does that work?
Yeah, that's partly my fault.
That's entirely your fault.
Yeah. the song is written by our singer Travis Jones and our bass player Chris Key, and Chris is a pretty interesting fellow. Part of his history is that he has a degree in ethnomusicology from Yale, and he constructed that song by taking very specific Caribbean rhythms and assigning them to the different instruments. So it's sort of New Orleans in a way, but it's really a little further south down in the Caribbean Ocean in the islands. But then when it was time for me to play, there's not a whole lot of Caribbean piano players I can call on. So I just sort of go with my gut and fake it, which is what I do a lot of, it turns out.
Let's take a listen to that. This is Mighty Red from the Houston Jones album, Calico Heart.
Plywood shack down a red dirt road. Lived a man of God, if the truth be told. He wore a 10-foot hat on the top of his head, and everybody called him the Mighty Red. A cross on the grave at the top of the hill, a statue of the king on his windowsill. He could tell your future for a dollar or a dime.
That's Houston Jones with a track from their new album. That's Mighty Red. Listening to that, it really does underline how the lines between types of music. I mean, New Orleans is
a little
part of the Caribbean practice.
Yeah, it is. That's where those rhythms came from, of course, because that was the central meeting place for a lot of that stuff. Yeah, I should mention, one of my heroes is Professor Longhair, famous New Orleans piano player, and that's sort of when I'm in doubt, I just go to that. And it seems to work for almost everything.
And I should mention that the person singing on that song is Travis Jones, who is the Jones half of Houston Jones.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about Travis Jones, because he's obviously, you guys formed the band together.
Well, he's got an interesting background. In his long, extensive musical career, he's fronted rock bands. rhythm and blues, country. And as a young boy, he sang gospel. His mom was a recording artist and sang some gospel and some blues. And he would join her at a young age singing some gospel. And more and more of the gospel music has found its way into our repertoire, actually. Our next CD will be part gospel. You know, some good percentage of it will be. But so, and Travis, so he's got that background, but he also has a background in musical theater. He played the role of Hank Williams in several productions of The Lost Highway. Hmm. And so he has that stuff down cold. If we ever need to pull out Hank Williams, we can do it pretty well. And he's done a number of musicals, and that part of his background gives him very good discipline as a musician. He brings a lot more to the band than your average singer. When it comes time to arranging music, we all contribute to that. His own background includes being music director for a number of stage productions. Mm. And so he thinks like somebody who needs to be able to put together the music that'll have an impact on an audience.
And so there's some serious stagecraft there as well.
Yeah.
Okay. But you still, the musical aspect of it is very, very strong, particularly the last song on the new album is called Roads to Dominion. It's 10 minutes long. And I wanted to play a little bit of that because it sounds, well, let's listen to it. Let's listen to a little section. This is Roads to Dominion by Houston Jones. Very short section of Roads to Dominion, of the last song on the new Houston Jones album, Calico Heart. Tell me a little bit about that. That is very far from the sort of Western swingy, good time New Orleans feel. Very far indeed.
That's Chris's degree in ethnomusicology showing. the background to the song, the basic framework is Ladino culture. In, I think, the 1300s, in any case, late Middle Ages in southern Spain, when the Jews and the Arabs peacefully coexisted and lived together. Some of this music is born of that, and so this is kind of an East meets West type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we on stage we like to call it Osama bin Laden meets Waylon Jennings.
And that was David Watts Barton talking with members of the Americana Quintet, Houston Jones. The band plays at the Black Oak Casino in Tuolumne tonight and at the Woodland Opera House on Saturday, July 11th. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on our guests and topics, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Kelly Menemeyer, Linnea Edmire, and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. The Sacramento County Sheriff's Department may have to lay off even more deputies than it originally expected. On the next Insight, we'll talk about this with Sheriff McGinnis. Also, in case of wildfire, consider staying home. That's how they do it in Australia. Experts debate this firefighting strategy. Plus, a new half-hour TV show about life in the California foothills. And more sound advice from classical music host Kent Teeters. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.